Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Kevin has seen Megalopolis, and he has thoughts. We have new trailers from Marvel and Ridley Scott, and Jason Reitman joins the show to discuss his new film Saturday Night.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 323 of Real Blend, a podcast that is neither live nor from New York and is not delivered on Saturday night. But this week, we're going to make a few exceptions. On this week's show, Kevin has seen Megalopolis and has some deep thoughts. We have new trailers for Marvel and for Ridley Scott that we're going to react to. And Jason Reitman returns to the show to discuss his new film, Saturday Night. Joined this week by, well, first off, I'm Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, co-host of the Real Blend podcast. Joined this week by Gabe Kovach and Kevin McCarthy. Hello, boys. How are we doing?
Hello, sir.
Hi, Sean. Is the last time we had Jason Reitman on was it with his father, Ivan Reitman, when they did Ghostbusters? Was that the last time we had Jason on the show?
I think so.
I believe so. Yeah.
I want to highlight that. I've said this before, but that's like one of my favorite interviews we've had on our show.
Really?
Because it was cool to have Jason and his dad, Ivan Reitman, and just kind of go through classic Ghostbusters stories. And I don't know how far or how long after that interview Ivan passed, but I don't think it was super long.
Within like a year.
That long
Yeah. And so just, you know, to have a father and son legacy chat about Ghostbusters and
And we mention this often, you know, to get them for the franchise that you want to sneak in questions about.
Yeah.
You know, like here they are coming back around for Afterlife and being able to dig deep into that conversation. And then also I noticed that Frozen Empire, which I had fun with, I enjoyed that's available on Netflix. People can now start streaming that. I think they just added it this past week. So
I thought it was so strange. I went to Halloween Horror Nights this past weekend in Hollywood and studio and Universal Studios. And they do all these, like, you know, you guys know, like the horror themed mazes, and they have Texas Chainsaw and they have Insidious and they have Purge and Quiet Place. And then there's a Ghostbusters Frozen Empire one specifically. And just thought,
really? That's kind of cool.
And I thought it was interesting. It just, I mean, I do consider Ghostbusters 1 and 2 to be scary in a way as a kid, but just it didn't feel like it fit into the scheme of horror films. It was like it was Insidious and then Ghostbusters Frozen Empire right next to each other, and I'm
what they have, can you tell me what they have?
It was like they're horror mazes, so like you walk through and you're basically walking through the frozen aspect of the film. People are frozen, there's characters jumping out, and like, you know, it's a haunted house essentially, but like it was themed out to Frozen Empire specifically. And also they did one, there's another one they did. I did the you know, the tram, the Hollywood studio tour, the classic studio tour. They still have Jordan Peele's Nope, the whole land from the character. Like it is so cool to see. It's like Jupiter's, I don't remember the name of the specific place in it, but they still have it, so it's interesting. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. Yeah, I hate those mazes. I am not a fan of that experience in the least bit. We have a small thing here at Carowinds, the park that's nearby us, and they do, they shut it down for Halloween and then decorate it with the mazes. And I know that the rule is that the people can't touch you.
Right.
You know, that they can get as close as physically possible without touching you. So if no one's been through one of these things before, the experience I had is people come running up to you at like full speed, you know, screaming and then stop at the very last second. And I want nothing to do with that. No, it's terrible. I hate it.
I hate
everything about it.
I got to go for Cinema Blend last year, I think it was. I got to go cover the Universal Horror Nights, which is cool. Awesome. I recommend if you can get a private tour as press. It's pretty great.
It's insane how many people are walking through there. You can't really get scared.
So the experience was great, but we went through every single one of them. And it's like 12 or 14 haunted houses. And we're going kind of one after the other. So after you get through about six and like you're like, oh, OK, like someone just kind of jumps out and you're like, oh, nice. OK. Like you're just like, you're like just kind of like the critical eye just starts coming through because you're like, I've seen this eight times and it all very fun. It really you start to get into like the theme of them and sort of like the storytelling or things that they do. But it was funny to go from sort of like tense to just like, oh, nice. OK, yeah, cool. Yeah. Scare around this corner.
You get used to it. They had one. Had a cool one. They had a cool one for the weekend.
I saw that
artist.
That
the weekend
was
that was really.
I don't know if it was the same as last year. It was really elaborate, so I assume they were similar. But
yeah, some of it's pretty brutal.
The Texas Chainsaw one kind of freaks me.
Oh, dude, he's like rips the face off and puts it on, it's like it's really disturbing.
They should do a Terrifier one, Kev.
Oh, dude. I don't know. That is, I don't want to get into too many details. We're trying to get Damian Leone and David Howard Thornton on the show for Terrifier 3. I have recently become a Terrifier fan. Jake was already in that boat before me. If you go to Spirit Halloween, you're going to be finding, like, I think Damian has created, Art the Clown's going to become one of the most iconic, like, iconic is a weird word to use because it's a killer,
mean,
but
no. It's like a mascot.
He's already there.
But like a Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger, he's like become part of that lexicon of like horror villains. But
yeah, he's transcended the movies.
Yes.
Like I know who Art the Clown is and I've never seen one of those movies and will never sit through.
It's a really disturbing character, but in the horror world he's become kind of a big deal, so.
Well, let's get through housekeeping really fast. Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit subscribe. Turn on your notifications, interact with us in the comments. We appreciate you guys sharing all your information when you, not information, but details and answering questions and chiming in about different things on the YouTube page. Of course, we're available all different places you get your audio podcast needs met. And if you would like to sign up for Real Blend Premium, it gets you an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from myself. So, Kev mentioned earlier that Jason Reitman has been on the show before. He was joined by his father, Ivan Reitman. He's always a good guest. This is a funny interview in that, and I can I'll break the fourth wall and let you know up front. I think the first two questions with Jason, we had to remind him that we're the type of show that he can drop his guard a bit, get out of junket mode a little bit. He was up at the Toronto International Film Festival. He was probably doing a ton of interviews on behalf of it. But I think you will see the moment when Jason, in the course of this interview, kind of goes like, oh, wait a second. Yeah, all right. We can actually have a conversation here. And then the rest of the interview was fantastic from that point on. Fun movie to talk about Saturday night. Kevin and I will react to it on the other side. We both have a chance to be able to take a look at it. But until then, this is Jason Reitman doing a non-spoiler conversation, not giving anything away about the movie, but just his reaction to Saturday Night Live and coming on the Real Blend podcast to promote his latest film.
We are the Real Blend podcast, and we are so, so happy that you are back on the show, man. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
I'm going to kick us off. I feel like one of the benefits of making this movie, you get to talk to everyone who was there that October night. And you are friends with a lot of people who are part of that original circle of SNL, which means you get to ask people the sort of questions that the three of us would love to ask, but would never be allowed to. So I would love to know, have you ever spoken with Bill Murray about his fight with Chevy Chase?
You know, Bill Murray was not actually part of the original season of Saturday Night Live. You know, the original seven were Gil Radner, Lorraine Newman, Jane Curtin, Garrett Morris, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, and Dan Aykroyd. And probably my favorite answer that I got out of Dan was, you know, I asked him what he was thinking, what he was feeling as the show went to air, and he said, you know, I just kept thinking, I still have a snowplow up in Toronto. So if nothing works out, I still have a job.
I one thing I do want to ask you, I love Eric Steelberg. I think he's like one of the, you know, the best DPs working right now. And I think you shot 16 on this, which I love. And I wanted to talk to you about the idea of the camera and the way you utilize the camera, especially in the beginning when we're watching the TV screen and we're almost like peeking behind people as they're walking across the screen. And then you have these incredible oners as well. And I wanted to ask about your narrative conversations that you have with Eric about designing a shot, the lens choices, and kind of what you want to express narratively through the lens and how he shoots the sequences.
You know, Eric and I have known each other forever. We started working together when we were 15 years old. So he's my lifelong DP. And this was the trickiest thing we've ever had to work on. You know, it's this organized chaos. There's 80 speaking roles in the movie. It's a 90-minute, basically, it's not a 90-minute, you know, movie. It's a 90-minute scene. And we rebuilt 8H, you know, the complete 8th and 9th floor of Rockefeller Center, and had to create these, almost, it's almost like a dance movie, the amount of choreography in it. So the idea was, how do you make sure that there's always something happening and it's always layers deep? How do we track all these different continuous storylines, not only the characters, but every prop, every set piece? How do we make sure we know where it is for 90 minutes straight?
Wow. Yeah, to that end, I want to know, did you sneak anything in that references your SNL skit, Death by Chocolate? Is there any kind of reference or
not? No, because my Death by Chocolate sketch would not be listed probably on, even on the top 1,000 sketches in SNL history. But but we do have lots of Easter eggs in there. You know, you get Al Franken eating out of a box of colon blown. There's an NBC page handing out a bottle of Swill. So the Bass-O-Matic blender is at Crafty. So for the avid SNL fan, there's lots of details. When you're backstage, there's always a showgirl and Abraham Lincoln and a llama. You know, there's all kinds of things that will nod to the hyper SNL fan. But even if you've never seen a Saturday Night Live episode, this is a movie about what happened in 1975 when a group of young people in their early 20s ripped television out of the hands of another generation and changed culture, changed comedy as we know it. We wanted to make a movie where SNL is the location, but what this is about is that moment where all these different personalities come together to put on a show.
Jason, to get ready for the movie, I started reading, and Sean has read it before, Live from New York, which is just such a great collection of incredible stories. But one of the things I felt was interesting plowing through this was how often you would read someone's recollection of a story, and then the next soundbite is someone else going, no, that's not how it happened. It actually happened like this. As a storyteller, how do you decide, I guess, which version of the truth to go with when crafting this script?
So, you know, Gil Kenan, my co-writer, and I, we interviewed over 30 people for this film. We interviewed Lorne Michaels, every living actor, every living writer, people who worked on crew, NBC pages, members of Billy Preston's band, every person we could find that was literally in the building on October 11th. And we collected all these stories, and you're right. I mean, they all contradicted each other because it's 50 years ago, and our memories, you know, play tricks on us. And at the end of the day, we were taking stories from not only the night of, but the months leading up, the months after, and coalescing them into one 90-minute movie that the job was not, okay, what happened? The job was, how do you get the audience to feel what it was like in the building? You know, I got to be a guest writer on SNL in, you know, 2008, as you referenced before, and all I remember is those minutes and seconds leading up to going live and how exhilarating it is. It's like an adrenaline usually reserved for test pilots and heroin addicts. And I wanted the audience to feel that, just that exhilaration pulsing through their veins.
Yeah, and part of the reason why you feel that is because of John's score, which is absolutely incredible. Like the way that score pumps through the film, it's like an atmospheric, it's literally, it's like it's not a visible character, but it feels like it's right there in the room with everybody. And I just wonder from a director perspective, obviously when you have a score that is that apparent to the audience and that almost like a ticking clock as we're watching, and the way he uses the drums and everything, can you speak about the narrative conversations you have with John about utilizing that score as a character as well?
Yeah, I mean, John's a genius. John was touched by God. I mean, he's like unlike any musician I've ever met in my life. And, you know, I was thrilled when he agreed to not only play Billy Preston, but also do our score. And we tried something completely unique that I'd never seen before, which was for him to create and record the score live on set. So after rap, we would show him edits of scenes, And he would literally just point to musicians and go, all right, try hitting an A flat, then go to a B, go to a G, and then you go to another like percussionist, and he would like literally mouth out a rhythm. You go chick 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 chick, and like literally, he would just create these ideas in real time. And then I'd show him another scene and go, think you'd write something that like sounds scary? And he's like, yeah. And then he would just go and like start creating something scary, and would change it, and then he would go to his piano and just start playing over it, and he would just point to a trumpet, and then point to a person on a drum. If you think about SNL being all about what happens in real time, what happens when a show is brought to you live, this was, what does it look like when a score comes right out of the composer's head and goes, you know, and you record it straight, like a direct feed, like it's having a direct line to his genius.
Incredible. That's it also was so terrifying. Cool. It's terrifying. I would be terrified of that. But I guess in the moment, it has to be really cool.
Well, it's about trust. You know, it's funny. I was talking to a director friend of mine right before I started, and I was telling him that I was nervous about a couple things. And he just said to me, you're making a movie about Saturday Night Live in 1975, some of the most dangerous comedians of all time. And then he just went, surrender. And yeah, so that was kind of it. Like every morning I had to kind of remind myself of that, that this is not going to be a traditional film where I get to control every little thing that happens. I have to surrender. Surrender to the music will be created in real time. See what happens. Surrender to the fact that the camera's trying to track 100 people at once. Surrender to the fact that, you know, yes, there is the actors right in front of camera, but the background is going to be changing it up. And the timing is going to be different every time. And that is the exhilaration of making a movie like this, is that it's going to surprise me and it's going to surprise the audience.
That actually feeds really great into my next question. What I want to ask about, there's just the beautiful scene where Belushi's going to try the triple axel.
Yeah.
On the ice skating rink. And Lorne at some point just has to sort of give in and support him, you know? And to me, I was wondering if there's an analogy in that to being a director on a set, where sometimes you just have to do whatever it takes to keep the train moving on the track.
100%. And, you know, as a director, you often feel like dad. You feel like you're everyone's dad. And and you have to be a different kind of dad to each kid. And Lorne, who, you know, grew up without a father, created an orphanage for all the wayward comedians and musicians he met. And has done that for 50 years. And that is definitely his relationship with everyone in the movie. Except for Rosie, you know, who's mom. But everyone else, he's kind of a different kind of father to the petulant children, the scared children, the proud children. And you can kind of see that in the way that he talks to everyone and tries to entertain their ideas and encourage them, but also, you know, chill them out when they're getting crazy.
It's pretty incredible to realize and be told and be given an example of how close SNL was to just not going on the air. The totally. Thing that was a part of our lives just almost didn't happen.
Yep.
And I would love to know, is there anything that's even close to that in terms of your career? What is the closest that one of your films came to maybe not happening?
Oh my God. I mean, nobody wanted to make Thank You for Smoking. Basically everyone told me that it was a great writing sample, and I started writing Up in the Air, and it wasn't till some internet millionaires each put up $1 million, and that's how, you know, Thank You for Smoking was financed. It's crazy now, because the people who financed Thank You for Smoking were Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and David Sachs. That's how that movie got made. You know, they had just sold PayPal to eBay, and that's how my first film was made. And when Juno came into my life, I read that script, and I thought, this is the greatest script I've ever read, and the company making it wouldn't even take a meeting with me. They met with 40 other directors, and they actually hired another director who was on it for a year. A director who's like actually a really good friend of mine now. And when that director left the project, they went back out, and that's the only reason I got the job. So you really never know how things are going to go in this life. And things that I thought would be successful failed. Things that I thought would never reach anyone became successes. And so I really relate to that. And, you know, Lorne was really up against the system. They really wanted to put reruns of The Tonight Show on Saturday. They certainly didn't want to do a 90-minute show that was counterculture and start all these young people that no one had ever heard of. But Lorne had a vision, and I think that's why I admire him so much. He had a vision that he couldn't totally articulate that represented the comedy of now, the music of now, and he's been able to recapture that every year for 50 years.
You know, to Jake's question and to point, like as the film progresses and we're leading up to this moment of the show going on the air, it did make me think about maybe a shot in your history, in your film history, that had a buildup like that, and then you called action, and but the buildup to it was in a similar like sense of like nervousness, like as you were building towards the shot, building the set piece, building the effect or whatever you were doing. I know it might not be comparable to what that moment was for SNL, or maybe it is, but do you have a shot in your filmography that felt like that?
That's a great question. And I'll be honest, it's every single shot of every day of my entire life. Because, you know, you write something and you plan it out and you prep it and you have an idea of what the scene is for months and sometimes years. And then you get to set and you say action, and all of a sudden it doesn't belong to you anymore. And that is the moment you have to surrender it to the universe, because the camera is not going to do exactly what you thought. The actor is not going to do exactly what you thought. The wind may blow something through the back of frame. A truck may go by and a horn goes off, you know. And being a director is half trying to control everything and half letting go and receiving the universe as it tells you, actually, this is what the scene's going to be. And it's your ability to kind of like come to terms with that. So it always feels like, all right, and here's the moment that I let it go and see how the boomerang comes back.
So just to add to that, is there one that you were building up to and then you...
You're like, dude, not the question I asked you. I asked you for a specific example. Don't fucking go turning around and trying to twist the question on me.
Is there one where you felt more relief after you yelled action, after the buildup? Like, can you think of one where it just went so... I mean, I'm sure you have a million, but... I'm just trying to figure out one.
You know, the more you have it locked in your brain. So when I think of a lot of like the closing moments of movies, of, you know, Juno and Bleak are playing the song at the end of the movie with the track start, you know, the track running through, or, you know, up in the air when George gets to Vera's door and the door is just starting to shut as you see the husband and kids walk through the background. There's these moments that get so locked in, that are so specific in your head, that you're almost scared to watch them happen. And on this movie, it was Corey Michael Smith as Chevy saying live from New York, it's Saturday night, the closing line of the movie, where we're shooting this movie in order, you know? Because the movie, you know, it's not like a normal movie where you shoot it out of order. Here you start at the beginning and you work your way to the end. And when we finally get to that line and he's about to say it, you could feel not only myself, you could feel the whole crew holding their breath. What is it going to feel like when you finally hear that line? Even when you watch an episode of SNL, you're just waiting through the cold open. Who's going to say it? When are they going to turn the lens? What's it going to sound like? And I hope that's how the audience feels when they watch this movie, that they've been building up for 90 minutes, anticipating what it would be like right before it finally went to air.
Well, thank you for the specifics on that one. I appreciate
it.
I appreciate it. I knew there was something there. I knew it.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Jason, I go down rabbit holes of listening to Lorne Michaels stories on podcasts and, you know, behind the scenes stuff. I love people who wrote for Saturday Night Live and The Simpsons. Like, I love hearing stories from from the writer's rooms of those two things. So there's a performance that I think isn't going to get celebrated as much because of the ensemble that you've put together. But I want to talk about Tommy Dooley.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so happy you're calling him out.
God, he's incredible. He's so good in it. So can you just talk about casting him and what you saw in him to come through with this sarcastic, you know, sardonic attitude?
Tommy Dewey is brilliant. And I cast him on my TV show Casual, and he was in my movie Frontrunner, and married my producer, Helen Estabrook. And Tommy is a genius. Tommy went to Princeton. So he's got the brain for it. But he also has this unique ability to make comedy out of anything. And you can write a gnarly line for Tommy Dewey, and it's still going to be funny in his words. So when I thought about who could play Michael O'Donohue, probably the darkest comedic writer I've ever heard of, there was only one guy I knew who could bring levity to it and do it in a way that where you still felt permission to laugh. He's just an extraordinary, underrated actor, and I think some people know him from like the Mindy Project, or they know him from like one thing or another. But he's a go-to actor. He is, like, you know, good in the locker room, as they say, and deep on my team of actors who I always want to work with.
Oh, he's so terrific in this movie.
Speaking of casting, I don't think there's a missed cast member of this movie.
Thank you.
There's one in particular I would love to know who the hell was that person, because it's almost too good.
Yeah.
Could you tell me who played Carson?
Oh, I love that you're calling him out. So Jeff Witzke is a guy that I've known since I was a teenager and has kind of been a part of every movie I've ever made, short film or feature. He's the kidnapper in Thank You for Smoking. He just shows up along the way. He introduces Clooney and Up in the Air at the convention at the end in Vegas. I'm so happy you're calling him out. But he's a guy who's just found a way into every movie of mine. He's an old friend. He's a great voiceover actor, and he does a killer Carson. He's played Carson like 5 times.
Oh, so you knew. It wasn't just like a, hey, can you do a good Carson?
No, no, no.
Like, you knew he could play Carson.
Yeah. No, he can not only do Carson, but he can do Carson in every era. So if you're like, I need Carson at like 38 years old, or I need Carson at 62 years old, he can give you that version.
That's amazing. He was fantastic. That was a great
incredible
scene.
Yeah.
Jason, I'm not telling you something you don't already know, but there are moments in this film. I mean, as an audience member from an immersion perspective, I didn't lose my immersion ever watching the film. But there are moments where Corey looks so much like Chevy Chase that it's actually shocking. Like to a point where I feel like I was literally watching. You somehow got older footage of him on that day and dropped him into this film. And I wonder sometimes how much that is angles. And I get that there's the makeup, there's the hair, there's the voice, there's the mannerisms, the way they carry themselves. There's also a way you shoot that character from the side or from a certain angle where it looks exactly like him. And I just wonder, like, when you're working with Eric and you know what you have, are angles playing at this, or is this just me overthinking it? It's pretty remarkable how much he looks like him.
Okay. I'm going to do the same thing, and I'm going to go sideways, right? I'm not going to answer your question, so just, like, forgive me in advance. But as I'm, like, casting these roles, I'm trying to think about what is the one thing that makes that person that character. When it came to Chevy, it was Corey's physicality. It's not the way he looks as much as the way he moves. When it came to Gilda, it was Ella's ability to do her voice. When it came to Belushi, it was exactly the way he looked. And when it came to Aykroyd, it was Dylan O'Brien's due to the cadence of his voice. There's one thing about each of those actors that becomes essential to believing in them as the person they are. And it's funny, when I look at Corey, yeah, he does look a lot like Chevy Chase, but more than anything, it's the way he moves. It's the way he cocks his head or opens his mouth or juts something out or does the fall that you immediately believe in the physicality of the performance.
It's just remarkable. Like, I really thought I was watching real footage of him, like, but, from that time.
But then it's interesting because, like, with Ella, who actually, you know, in real life doesn't look a lot like Gilda, there's a place she goes with her voice. And, like, the moment that she goes there...
Yeah,
it's immediately Gilda, and there's an empathy in her eyes that gives you the fairy dust that we associate with Gilda, as opposed to Dylan, who, as soon as he gets the cadence right, He is Dan Aykroyd, and he can do that rhythm. He knows exactly where to pause, and he knows. Also, Dylan is a fountain of odd facts and figures that allows him to take that Aykroydian verbosity to like the nth level.
Yeah, what you're explaining kind of reminds me of when I saw Danny Boyle's Steve Jobs. Like, I didn't think Fassbender looked like Steve Jobs, but he embodied the mannerisms and the physicality, and you believe it. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at with that as well. I just think it's an interesting thing how our minds connect it to the real person, even if they might not look just like them.
Speaking of Fassbender, we did a live read once of The Big Lebowski at the Comedy Festival in Montreal for like 2,000 people. And X-Men was shooting in town, so we got almost the entire cast of X-Men to be in it. And Fassbender, his favorite movie of all time is The Big Lebowski. And he came and he played the dude. And you've never seen anything stranger than Michael Fassbender showing up in wardrobe, wife beater, robe.
White Russian.
Pocket full of J's, smoking for real on stage. And he already knows the whole movie by heart. He doesn't need to read the script. He's off book because Fassbender knows the dude. But you look at him and you're like, you're not the dude.
I know. It's so crazy. That's the brilliance of acting. That's what it is right there, man. Yeah.
Well, Kevin is setting me up yet again beautifully. I want to talk about Nicholas Braun nailing Andy Kaufman, because I had just happened to see the first episode of Saturday Night Live before going to see your screening. Yeah. So I knew Wolverines. I knew how it was going to start. But like, that's not something that people could just call to mind.
Yeah.
But Andy Kaufman's Mighty Mouse bit is something that is like ingrained in our personality. Yeah. And if you guys don't get it, it doesn't work. So when you saw Nicholas do it for the first time, what was that like?
Extraordinary. I mean, it's funny because, you know, we wrote the role of Jim Henson for Nicholas Braun. But the Andy Kaufman thing was an afterthought. It was like, oh, you know, he would also be great at that. And there's all these ways that we were trying to mirror an episode of SNL in our construction of our film. And one of those ways was, you know, an actor can play more than one character. And
oh, cool.
And the first time I saw him do Andy Kaufman was live on set. Like I didn't see him rehearse it. So I just have faith in him as a comedian. And he completely delivered.
Oh, my God. Yeah, nailed it.
Jason, I have a bit of an inside baseball question, and if I am mixed up on this, please correct me, but I am genuinely curious. So SNL is an NBC show, and NBC is owned by Universal, which is a different movie studio. We love our friends at Sony. Sony's an amazing studio. Would this have been an easier production for you if it had been a Universal film? Did making it with Sony, were there any restrictions? Was there anything that you wanted to do that you would have been able to do had you been under the Universal banner?
I'm thrilled that we got to actually shoot the movie that we wrote. And the writing of this movie was a fascinating process because, look, I had to try to do your jobs. You know, Gil and I were trying to become journalists for the first time in our lives. And we interviewed all these writers and actors and craftspeople. And we wrote this script. I mean, we wrote such a detailed outline. It was kind of like True Detective. Like, we had a murder board of like where everyone was and where they are in the building and how do we track everything. And we wrote this crazy outline. And then we actually wrote the first draft of the script in 3 days because we were so detailed as to knowing what was going to happen when and where. And we got to make the movie that we actually wrote. And we always treated it as though this could have been a movie about the moon landing. This could have been a movie about, you know, World War I. It just so happens that it was about the creation of one of the most iconic television shows of all time. So we researched it. We did the journalism and tried to put the audience right on the floor of, you know, 8H, so they could feel what it was like on opening night.
Well, right down to including the Billy Crystal potato chips bit.
Yeah.
Like, once I saw that play out, I was like, oh, these guys really read every story they could get.
Billy, so I, you know, I've known Billy for years because my dad did a movie with Billy. And when I called him up, I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'll talk to Billy. He'll tell me the story of what it was like to be there. And the amount of emotion that welled up immediately, you know, for him, it's like it happened yesterday. And the most extraordinary thing was this. We had been looking for a copy of the script of opening night, and we couldn't find it. Nobody had it. Everybody, even Alan Zweibel, who kept everything, didn't have it. We wanted to read this script about Alexander the Great, which was Michael O'Donoghue's sketch that got cut because George Carlin refused to act on opening night. And the only person who had it was Billy Crystal. And we went over to his house, and he pulled out the script, and he flipped to a page, and he goes, "That's where I was supposed to be."
Oh,
and
man.
We asked if we could get a copy of his script, and he said, yeah. And so we, you know, we scanned it right there and then using our phones. And that's the script that everyone on set is handling in the movie. So the only reason we had the script is because Billy was the only one who kept his copy. And the actual script that whenever they're handing out new pages and they're flipping through and all this stuff, that's Billy's copy of his opening night script.
That's awesome.
Right.
That's really cool. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, you're the first people I've shared that with. I forgot. I keep on forgetting to tell people that story.
Don't tell anybody else that story.
We got the exclusive here. All right, Jason, I'm jumping in for another specific question. There's a scene in the film where a lot of things go wrong, obviously, but a lighting fixture falls on the set. And it's a kind of, obviously, I would imagine that happens. I mean, obviously, safety and nowadays, I'm assuming, is a lot different than it was at that point as well. But I'm just curious, on any of your film sets, have you had anything like that ever happen where a close call where like something fell or like something broke? Yeah. Give me a specific answer.
they do. And like, you know, I'd love to make light of it, but it's actually scary, you know, is the truth of it. I've had a couple close calls. I've had a couple close calls with cars. I think there's a lot of fear around guns on set. But I find cars are just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, because we don't think of them as dangerous. Guns, there's a lot of protocol around how to handle firearms on set. But cars, people just kind of jump in cars and they're like, oh, I drive a car every single day. And, you know, making movies is a circus. And it draws circus folk. Like the people who decide, I want to do this for a living, I want to wake up at the crack of dawn, pack the trucks, empty the trucks, go to a new location, walk through the mud, it's going to be freezing cold, it's going to be blazing hot in the desert. Like, it attracts a kind of person who wants to be part of the circus life. And the circus life is dangerous, is the truth of it. And I know you weren't looking for, you know, a touchy-feely answer here, but the truth is that every time you go to make a scene, you're doing something that's never done before, and oftentimes shit like that happens. And it is scary because you don't know what's going to happen anytime you do something that's said. You try to take protocol. We do a lot of safety meetings, and I'm really proud of my sets. They're safe sets, but still you're dealing with the level of unknown. And as a result, I don't know. You never know what's going to happen. And so when I look at a moment like that, I mean, it's obviously very funny in the movie, but that echoes definitely things that I've felt on set.
Scary. It is scary. You know, and I appreciate the answer. I appreciate the realism.
Look, you wanted a real answer. You got a real answer.
No, I got it. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, we'll end on something a little more upbeat. I think the question that everyone's going to be asking coming out of this movie is, was the Milton Berle Chevy Chase interaction based on factual events?
Yeah. I don't know if Milton ever pulled out his penis for Chevy Chase, but Milton definitely pulled his penis out for Alan's wife, Belle, and a bunch of other people that I know. This wasn't a one-time thing, and it's hard to fathom the behavior of a lot of people back then.
It's really terrible. The look on Corey's face in that scene... The way he breaks Chevy's character in that sequence, the way that moment does that, that is, to me, one of the best performances in the whole film, is the look on Corey's face in that moment.
I'm so happy because you called it out. I totally agree.
Because he has, like, this confidence the whole movie, and then, boom, it just breaks him.
It's the cracked smile, you know? And
brutal.
People are always kind of... People have a hard-on for big acting. And they get really excited when actors go to a 10. But the great acting is the subtle stuff. It's the tricky stuff. It's when you see someone feeling five different things at once and it's trying to squeeze through a little funnel. What not only Corey is doing in that scene, but what JK is doing in that scene and what Kai is doing in that scene, where they're each feeling three different things, hiding their emotions, presenting something else. One of those scenes that's fun to write, hard to act, and as a director, a thrill to watch happen live.
Jason, we know you have a super busy day, man. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. It's always good to see you.
Are you kidding me? You guys are a blast. This is the highlight of the day. I had such a fun time. Thanks, guys.
We would like to thank both Jason Reitman and our good friends at Sony for helping us set up the Saturday night interview. We're rolling it this week because the film is going to be in limited release. It's going to be in New York and LA. I think they're platforming it out. I believe Sony wants to kind of extend the release of this film because it got incredibly good reviews up at the Toronto International Film Festival. And then it was, I believe it played Fantastic Fest. It was one of the surprise screenings at Fantastic Fest. And Jason was down there to promote the film as well, too. So it feels like they're ramping up for a bit of an awards play with this one. And everywhere it goes, it gets incredibly good reviews. Like even the reactions out of Fantastic Fest, people were saying how blown away they were. That tends to be a bit of a horror genre fest. And so I think Saturday Night was deemed as like an unusual choice until people saw it. Like it is a kind of counterculture, you know, comedy. It's for people who don't know, the structure of it is it's the 90 minutes before the launch of the very first episode of Saturday Night Live. And it follows a young Lorne Michaels, and it has all of these actors who are stepping in for very famous cast members from Saturday Night Live, whether it's Dan Aykroyd, Gilda Radner, Chevy Chase. Terrific, terrific interpretations of these characters. Kev, I loved this movie. I thought it was a ton of fun. I thought it was a really good, it felt a little bit Sorkin-esque. In the fact that it's just moving constantly, you know, it's behind the scenes, behind the look at putting Saturday Night Live together. Some of the pressure that was on Lorne Michaels about whether NBC was even going to let him go live that night. You know, for people who don't know the history of Saturday Night Live, NBC back in the day used to run reruns of the Johnny Carson show. And essentially Carson said like, hey, I want you to stop running reruns on Saturday nights, fill the time with something else. And so NBC executives kind of hired Lorne Michaels and said, come up with an idea, or he had pitched the idea and they said, all right, let's go. But they were ready to go to Carson reruns if Saturday Night Live wasn't ready to go in the moment. And as you'll see over the course of that movie, there were a lot of obstacles to these 20 somethings getting to the stage. That line in particular of how these people were all in their 20s floored me when I heard it, because I was like, God, they were like kids. You know, they legitimately were kids who were about to go live on television and launch this thing. And now the show is celebrating its 50th anniversary as it starts to go live with new episodes. But yeah, I had a blast with this, man. Did you enjoy this as much as I did?
Yeah, I thought it was incredible. As someone, I watched Saturday Night Live. I try to every single week, and I've always been a fan of it. I grew up watching it. I've always been fascinated just the idea that it is live. Sketches are cut mid-show. Actors are reading off of cue cards that are apparently changed right up until the minute they go on the air. Sometimes I think in the middle of segments they're changed. I have no idea how it's such a talent to be able to do these sketches and make it seem like it's happening, you know, for, you know, in real time, rather than knowing that they're reading things or they're looking off camera. I know I've been interested. I would love to interview Lorne Michaels, because I always heard that he hates when the cast breaks into laughter. And I always think those are the best moments. There's a Debbie Downer episode with Rachel Dratch, and Lindsay Lohan was hosting the show that week, and they're at Disney World or Disneyland, and Jimmy Fallon's in it. And it's just one of those sketches where they're all breaking and it's brilliant. Like, it's just so funny. What I loved about the film is the rush. It feels like you're running a race for 90 minutes. And I love a ticking clock. I love that they just kind of remind you where you are in the hour and a half. I love things taking place in real time. Do you remember a movie years ago? I think it was like in the 90s or early 2000s, called Nick of Time, with Johnny Depp.
Didn't that
take place in 90 minutes, like a similar? And I remember that, thinking that was such a cool, I know it's been done before in other films as well, but I just remember that film in particular kind of playing that idea. Eric Steelberg, who's Jason Reitman's DP, has been for a long time, just like the brilliance of how they shot this on 16 millimeter. It feels like you're watching a documentary of the real moment in time. Like your suspension of disbelief gets to a point where you actually feel like you're literally watching just footage of like Chevy Chase. It really feels like you're looking at real documentary footage. And also John Baptiste did the score for the film. Apparently he scored it live during parts of the shooting of it. And it is just like this fast paced piece of music that is so well timed with the dialogue delivery, and the performances are incredible. And it's just paced really well. Like they go to air, but
yeah,
I was worried they weren't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and a big thing that lends to the documentary feel of it is how good some of these performers are as people who we know. Like, you can't take the image of Chevy Chase out of your brain.
It's exact. This guy, was it Corey Michael Smith?
Corey Michael Smith.
Oh,
Corey Michael Smith plays young Chevy Chase, and it's the mannerisms, it's the voice, it's the physicality. Like, the way that he carries himself is unbelievably good. I thought Dylan O'Brien as a young Dan Aykroyd was incredible. I really want to shout out who played, let me
see. Is it Ella Hunt?
Ella Hunt, who played Gilda Radner.
Oh my gosh, she was unbelievable. Yeah,
And then even Gabriel LaBelle, who we kind of know from The Fablemans, does an incredible job of playing Lorne Michaels. And Lorne Michaels is an unusual case in that he should be a behind the scenes guy, but he's so famous that we all know what he sounds like. We know who he is. I'm kind of obsessed with Lorne Michaels' stories. I was saying that to Jason Reitman about this. I could listen to podcasts about former SNL people talk about their experience on the show for days. And in fact, I do quite often. I'll pull up like YouTube clips of old cast members on shows like Conan O'Brien or David Spade and Dana Carvey do an incredible show together, where whenever they have someone on from the Saturday Night Live days, I get drunk on their stories, because everyone's experience at that show is completely different. And some of them are really traumatic. And even the ones that you think are incredible success stories will tell you how nerve-wracking it was on a weekly basis. Kristen Wiig was a guest on Conan O'Brien's show, and hearing her talk about the struggle, you know, to come up with something creative week after week after week is real and shocking, because you think that like she had an incredible run, and she did.
Right.
But, you know, her and Will Ferrell will tell stories about like how difficult it was, and you thought it just came easy to them. And this is just a sliver of this. But like, I think you could legitimately take these cast members and just keep jumping to like different generations of SNL.
Be awesome.
And keep telling different stories. Yeah, it'd be incredible.
Is it Rachel Sennott from Bodies, Bodies, Bodies?
I think it's pronounced Sennott.
Okay, I don't want to botch her last name, but I think she's one of my favorite actors working right now. Just from a performance perspective, I thought she was good in Bodies, 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 but she's great in this as Rosie Schuster.
God,
I love her. I think she's incredibly talented, and I've just been watching. I've only seen a couple of performances from hers over the past few years, but I think she's going to be one of the bigger talents of this generation. Like, she is an incredible part of this movie as well. Just wanted to shout her out, because I think, I remember seeing Bodies, Bodies, Bodies and like really loving her performance in that. And then she crushed it in this.
She's terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's like, I'm glad to single out these people, because there's even some like Willem Dafoe is terrific.
Dafoe is so good. Nicholas Braun.
J.K. Simmons is terrific as Milton Berle in a very funny sidebar that people are going to check out. I want to shout out Cooper Hoffman too.
Oh, yeah.
The son of Philip Seymour Hoffman. He plays Dick Ebersol in this. He's kind of like the counterpart to Lorne Michaels. Like, there's a really great push
LaMorne
and pull
Morris.
Between like, yeah, LaMorne Morris is terrific as Garrett. There's a push and pull between like creativity and the business side that I think is a really interesting look at. Yeah. I think Jason Reitman has a good handle on that. You know, obviously is coming up as somebody who came up in a family that's so deeply tied to all the comedians who are associated with Saturday Night Live. So I'm really glad he got a chance to tell this story. Like, I think he was the right choice to write and research and then spin this. So I highly recommend Saturday Night. I hate to frame it this way, but like, do you think anyone stands out enough to get awards consideration for their performances?
Or it's such an ensemble.
Like a screenplay?
It's such an ensemble. But I don't know. I mean, Gabriel LaBelle is incredible. Like,
I could see Corey Michael Smith maybe getting a run.
Yeah, but everyone's great at it. I mean, Ella Hunt, I mean, there's just like every performance works so well. I mean, the Defoe, J.K. Simmons. I mean, it is just, I think it's probably my favorite Reitman film maybe since like Up in the Air.
I put Up in the Air. Yeah.
Yeah.
Up in the Air there for sure. I think that's a flawless movie.
Juno and Thank You for Smoking. And like, you know, I really like his work. Did he do Labor Day as well with?
He did. Kate Winslet.
Kate Winslet and Brolin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
I always forget they were in that together. But yeah, Reitman's kind of one of those like filmmakers that you forget how good he is. Like, he just has an incredible filmography.
Well, then he shifted over to the franchise. You know, he did Ghostbusters for a little bit.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy to see him drift back over in this direction, because I think this is really strong. And again, like I said, I just think he's the right person to sort of tell this story. So.
And I also just like filmmakers who stick with like certain people they work with, like Eric Spielberg's his DP for so many films, and they just have such an interesting language together. Like, I think the opening of this film, when you're looking at a TV screen and you're like, people are walking by, you're almost like peeking into the world, and like the way Spielberg lenses it and shoots it, it's such an interesting conversation they must have been having about how to frame this film, because it feels like a race. Yeah.
No, and it doesn't lose the aspect of putting on live television.
No.
You know, you're watching a film, but you definitely feel like you're watching something that's being put together for television.
It's cool.
So, that's an important component to put together. All right. I want to shift gears because I got to talk about this film. I haven't had a chance to see it. I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to see it. But Kevin, you got a chance to see Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis.
Yes.
And specifically, I bring this up because today a really funny tweet came across about this unusual aspect of this movie that I was super curious how they were going to put this together. But there's a moment in Megalopolis where I think Adam Driver's character is participating in a press conference. Mm-hmm. Can you set this up? Can you explain to the people what is happening in it?
Yeah, I mean, like, okay, so I saw the movie a couple weeks ago, so I'm trying to remember the exact scenario. But there's a sequence in the film where Driver's character is taking a question from somebody. And that question... it's so funny because am I reviewing the film now?
Well, I would set up this scene.
Okay.
They're changing it. They have to take it away.
So what I remember specifically was during the movie, there's like the sequence where they take the screen down to this one block of image. So like the entire rest of the screen is black and it's just Adam Driver's character taking a question from somebody. And when at my screening, my rep got up and went down to the front of the theater, set up like a question board that you would have in front of you, and you could hear the question being asked in the audio of the film, and then my rep had to mimic or mime the dialogue that was being said by this reporter in the scene. And it was just so strange. It was so like, I'd never seen anything like it. But again, because the whole screen was black except for this one little square bar, a square area with Adam Driver's character in it. And then he mimicked, I could just see his mouth moving with the dialogue that was on the screen. And then he packed up this what do you call this, that thing? It's in front of you.
Like a podium?
Podium
like
of a some podium? Sort. Yeah. Podium? And he brought it back and sat back down behind me. And then the movie went on. It was like an hour and like 23 minutes into the film or something.
So this happened so at the strange. Venice Film Festival and people got to see it for the very first time. And someone at the Venice Film Festival came out and did this pantomime that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the conversation became for like film nerds. It was like, well, how are they going to do this when it's playing at your local AMC?
Right.
Well, the answer becomes they're not.
They can't.
Anymore.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how they would do that for every screen across the country. That have to have somebody like literally step in and do it, which I thought was interesting. I'm like, are they really going to continue this throughout the whole theatrical run?
I love that Francis Ford Coppola is doing something so out of the box like this. It's just practically you can't do it anymore. So what they've done now is they have spliced the question and answer back into the finished film. And now if you go see Megalopolis, apparently it you'll hear the audio or the person might appear in the thing.
Yeah, because you don't you still hear the in my screening, you still hear the question being asked in the audio of the film. My rep didn't speak. He just mimed the words.
And this happened to Jake's screening also.
Yeah,
like, so his rep also had to get up and pretend that they were
not necessary. Like, the scene still works as is if it needs to be done without somebody going up there at a podium and pretending to say the words. I think it was more of a visualization, because in the movie, if I remember correctly, it's just a shot on Adam's face. And so you just hear.
But he's looking. Is he looking?
Yeah, he's looking at something. Yeah. Honestly, I'm telling you, I saw this movie is 2.5 weeks ago. I did not love the film. So that experience is my memory of that experience is what I'm saying to you right now. I don't think I'm misremembering it, but that's what it was like when I saw it.
So it was to your recollection. It served no purpose. Like there was no like, you didn't get like a, oh, this was happening in the film, and so this lent to this theme, or this lent to the, it's just a thing.
It didn't feel, no, it didn't feel like anything
so weird
necessary. Like had the scene happened the way it was shot and shown on screen with the audio that I heard, I wouldn't have lost anything. Yeah. But I guess because the image becomes this bottom square rectangle of just Adam at some kind of press conference, then I guess it makes sense why they would try and do something like that. But I don't know.
Is he an actor in the movie? Is he a political leader? What is his character?
His character.
What is this movie about?
He's essentially trying
to get into your reaction.
Now let's hear your review.
Well, he's like, essentially his character's trying to create a futuristic world. So the movie takes place in modern times, but it almost operates in like old school Roman times in terms of the way the world works. And so like, for example, the Dustin Hoffman character and the Giancarlo Esposito character want to keep things the old way. They want to build the cities with concrete and like, you know, the old school way that we do things. And Adam's character has come across some technology that enables him to stop time in a way, and they kind of experience time in a frozen state. And to be honest with you, I genuinely am confused as to what the film was even trying to say in that regard. But his character is a futuristic, he's looking to the future and wants to build a new world using the new technologies that are available to him. And there's this pushback from the people who want to keep it in the older school fashion. And so Giancarlo Esposito and Dustin Hoffman are on that side of it, and Adam Driver's character is on the other side of it. And he has like this ability again to stop time. And he's just this mega tech guy who wants to use advancements to try and help better our world. But the movie is modern, but also takes place with the way the characters operate are like they're in like old school Roman times. It's very interesting. Like Shia LaBeouf is in it, Adam Driver, Aubrey Plaza. Yeah, it is an interesting, and Natalie Emanuel, Giancarlo Esposito.
All right. Were you? I have so many questions. Were you at all entertained?
No.
Like that's okay. That's the thing that that's the thing about this film that I just don't understand is, were you at all entertained? Like,
no.
Like, weird can be fun.
It sounds ambitious.
It's ambitious, but also I just found it to be, incredibly boring. I found it to be the script to be just not entertaining and not engaging in any way. Okay. I think Adam Driver is great as always. Like the performances are great. Like Giancarlo Esposito is great. Natalie Emanuel is great. Aubrey Plaza is great. Like everybody delivers good performances. The material that they are given to play with, I did not find to be engaging. And to be honest with you, it's been so long. It's been 2.5 weeks since I've seen it. I've seen so much in between that the movie did not stay with me.
I have more questions. Just because I'm trying to just get an understanding about like what to even expect from this.
Yeah.
Does this pass a threshold of I think if you're like a certain film fan, you're like, I got to see the new Francis Ford Coppola to complete that sort of see all of
I feel
that
like
person's
I have
work.
To see
right.
it. Yeah.
But Kevin, do you feel like it crosses a threshold of like, no, you should see this because of X, Y, or Z of why it's so crazy or weird or whatever. You just need to sort of experience and to understand that it exists. Or are you like, it's not even worth the run sitting down for the runtime?
I honestly found it incredibly irritating. Like I admire the ambition. I admire that he's self-funded. the film. I admire that he still wants to tell big stories and try to do them in a unique way. This is not meant to come across as like hateful towards a filmmaker. I never want to be negative in that sense. I mean, as a critic, I will sit here and tell you if the movie's worth seeing or not, and I'll tell you what I liked and disliked about a movie. I don't take joy in being negative towards a film. I just found it to be mind-boggling and just ridiculous and over the top, but not in a good way. And to a point where when my rep got up to do the thing at the front of the theater, I knew how far into the movie he was doing it. And I knew that there was another hour left. And I was just like, I don't understand where this is like going at this point, like to a point where I have forgotten a lot about that movie almost to
that can be
like,
so frustrating.
Right. And so it's just I'm just so confused. Like I was driving home just thinking to myself, like, I don't get how that movie was made by that filmmaker. But, you know, there's art and there's ambition and there's things in there that I think might work and resonate for people. I think the Rome aspect of it with the modern times, and it just played strangely. Like the Shia LaBeouf character is so, it just doesn't fit. It feels like it's not working the entire movie.
It's I wanted to go to its Rotten Tomatoes score. It's at 51%. That sounds exactly right for this movie.
Yeah.
It sounds like half the people dig it, half don't get it.
I wanted it to be amazing. It's Coppola. But what was Coppola's last good movie?
This reported budget is $125 million.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
He makes wine now. He's a wine aficionado now at this point. So a wine aficionado who occasionally makes movies. All right, let's throw to a quick break. And on the other side, we're going to react to two new trailers that dropped this week and send you guys out into the woods. And we are back. All right, so a couple of trailers dropped this week that we wanted to discuss. One for a movie that's coming out later this year and one that we have to wait till next summer to break down. First one is Gladiator 2. Friend of the show, Sir Ridley Scott. Kev, to sort of speak to a director who kept going and
there are filmmakers who do well keeping going. Like,
when we spoke to Ridley actually and mentioned the fact that if he had stopped at 10, he would not have made a movie called Gladiator, which was his 11th film. He's returning to very familiar territory. I made Kevin watch this trailer in order to talk about it on the show, and then I felt bad as I was watching it, because this is the type of trailer that gives away
everything.
Almost the entire movie.
Yes.
Yeah, almost the entire movie. And it looks... Look, I'm very excited for Gladiator 2. I'm excited for Ridley painting on a massive canvas. It looks like an epic story told on a massive scale. I enjoyed Napoleon. I thought he, you know, was doing some incredible work there with Napoleon, also telling a large sort of military epic. I can't not say that this doesn't look like Gladiator just told on a bigger frame, essentially. It looks to be like the recruitment of a gladiator to, you know, plucked from obscurity. Who has a deeper sort of vengeance mission at play. This time it's Paul Mescal. I was kind of shocked that the trailer for this one gives away the connection, although I think the information was out there for anybody who wanted to dig, but this trailer makes it very clear that this is the son of Maximus, Russell Crowe's character from the first movie. But yet still, with everything that's being told, it looks like the battles look bigger. We've been discussing on the show that, like, it looks like they flood the Colosseum and they have the boats battling against each other the way that they used to do in these Roman Colosseums. We have rhinoceros and we have feral chimpanzees, it looks like. It looks great, but it looks like Gladiator on steroids, and they're just calling it Gladiator 2.
Yeah, the trailer is really interesting. We talked about like exactly that point. It has a lot of member berries. It has a lot of like, this is, you remember Gladiator. And the only thing that I could maybe a saving grace is that this trailer has all of them, because it does point to some like what seems like in the trailer kind of B plots of like Denzel's character wanting to like take over the throne.
Sure.
Is a different thing than what was going on in Gladiator. And then Pedro Pascal's character kind of being like a reluctant, disillusioned sort of general that is going to be that is gets recruited to help him. Like they point to some, again, is that the A plot or is that just kind of a B plot that's just going to flavor this to be a little bit different? Like, I'm curious on that scale. This trailer is very much Gladiator. But is this most of what's in there that's supposed to feel like Gladiator to get people to show up? And then we're going to actually get a nice original story.
I will say that when we were at CinemaCon in Vegas earlier this year, they showed an 8-minute package for Gladiator 2. And it did hint at a Denzel subplot that is not in this trailer.
Okay.
That's all I'll say. And I think there might be more to this movie than we're seeing in the trailer. Yes. To sort of pick up the thread that you're putting down. Yeah. I think there's more to this. I think it's going to go to some other
places. I hope so. And I think that the other side of that is that Joseph Quinn's character is kind of a metaphor for what the rest of the film could be, which is his character just seems like two of Joaquin Phoenix, you know, like it's going to be like, remember that fight? Well, there's two of them. Like,
yeah,
remember this? Yeah. Well, now it's flooded. Like,
I'm 6'5" and there's two of me.
Exactly. Like, it's kind of a metaphor of like, what if we just doubled down on everything from Gladiator?
But then all the things you just mentioned, as long as it's being done by Denzel Washington, Pedro Pascal,
and Joseph and Quinn,
like, I'm in, and Paul Mescal looks great. Like, I'm in. I think it looks great.
I think it looks entertaining. Like, it looks like it's gonna hit the mark.
You think you'll be entertained?
I think that'll be the question.
Are you not? Are you not entertained? Kev, what stood out to you in the trailer? Anything?
So, okay, I'm excited about it. Basically, reason you said is because of the cast. But I got to tell you, when Gladiator 2 came up on the screen as the title, it felt like it. I don't know. I had this weird feeling in my stomach, like this is what people talk about when they talk about sequels, like in the sense of it feels like the Hollywood. This is the Hollywood stereotype of how of what they do with a film that does really well. Now, this is years later, so you can't really argue.
Sweet time with it,
right? They took a long time to do it. I just don't think that the Gladiator movie would in my head would ever have seen two next to it. Like two.
Well, you know what it is?
You know
it's almost like if we stepped into Last Action Hero.
Yes, that's what
this
it feels
would be
like.
A movie.
Yes.
This would be a movie that they're making fun of.
Right. Well,
where you'd be like, what? Arnold did a Gladiator sequel?
Right. But it's so funny because I am the first person to tell you that I think sequels are underrated. Terminator 2, Empire Strikes Back, Wrath of Khan, Aliens. You know, there are some of the greatest films of all time are sequels.
I love them.
I just think Back to the Future and all and you know, Indiana Jones, all these films. And I just genuinely, I don't know, for some reason, seeing Gladiator and then two just felt strange. But at the same time, it is the same filmmaker. It is an incredible cast. There is seems like a good story. I think Paul Mescal does look and sound like Russell Crowe. A bit in that role. The Denzel part of it is actually what intrigues me the most. I think the look of his character, the way he's carrying himself, I think, do you think it's going to be like unhinged Denzel a character? Like where he's like, it's like in terms of like, do you think he's going to be like over the top? Because I think
I think it's going to be quiet, powerful Denzel.
Okay.
Like
Joseph's the loud character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like
he's
loud,
letting you know that he's in control.
Right.
But he's doing it in a way like fences Denzel.
Like, I wonder because I love Denzel Washington, like in like these like big power roles where he's like, you know, over the top. Sure. And I just think the Joseph Quinn character seems like he's going to be a lot more over the top. But I think you're right. I think there's a quiet power to.
You may not get a King Kong speech.
Right.
Out of Denzel and Gladiator 2.
But it does seem like the character could go into a badass direction. I think you're right. I think there's a quietness to his power. And I think that's probably
he's manipulating behind the scenes.
I think so too. Yeah, yeah.
I think Pedro also might get a chance to sort of go a little over the top because there is a battle sequence with him and Paul Mescal. So we'll see how that shakes out.
Cool.
But yeah, I'm excited. To your end, I almost think it would be unusual if we saw, like, imagine seeing a trailer for Saving Private Ryan 2.
Right.
Where they have to, like, save a different Private Ryan.
Turns out there was another brother.
We got to fight. Right, exactly.
Yeah. by the way, there was a fourth brother that we didn't realize. Yeah. And we have to go save. And his name is also Ryan, too.
And they show Tom Hanks. He's like, remember this. Oh, earn this. Oh, he's got to earn. He's got to earn it again.
I just feel like that's what that feels like to me. It's like Gladiator feels like, I mean, listen, Saving Private Ryan is obviously a very different genre. But it does feel like that in a way that, like,
the point's made.
Why would there be a sequel? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that this trailer points to Gladiator, and I think my hope, and maybe it's wishful thinking, is that it's just trying to sell itself as the really popular movie that you guys saw 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And that the movie actually has more to offer
25 years
than that.
Oh my God. But
yeah.
I don't know. I've been in this industry for a really long time.
I think Sean's right though, about the quiet power of Denzel. Like, even at the end of that trailer, like, there's a weight to his delivery, but he's chill and calm about it.
You think he says, the Minotaur ain't got shit on me in this one? Is that what he's about to say?
Minotaur
on fire.
I want Denzel should be in every movie, and he's the best. Like, he is the reason I'm excited about Gladiator 2. Sure.
Oh yeah,
I will buy a ticket because of Denzel.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
All right. The other one is Marvel's Thunderbolts. Trailer dropped for this on Monday. Obviously, I'm in the tank for this movie. It's Marvel. I'll be going to see almost anything they go see. So I will defer to you two to tell me whether this trailer did anything to get you excited for the release of Thunderbolts.
I would say more than I thought it would. Seeing that cast come together, I was more excited about, because we've been introduced to those characters. It doesn't have the, like, Avengers appeal of, like, oh shit, it's going to be everybody and it's going to be massive. It does feel like a sort of individual Marvel movie at that point. But I did get kind of excited at, like, oh, I wonder how they could play with these characters, seeing Bucky as, like, feels like he's going to be sort of a moral compass for this group, I imagine, just because we kind of see him as, like, a good, good guy. I do have a question for you, Sean. The thing that, and maybe it's just David Harbour saying it over and over again, but, like, they keep talking about how this is a new direction for Marvel. This is a different thing. Mm-hmm. This is a Marvel we haven't seen, which like, feels like a sales pitch and feels like that could be sort of a bit of a, like, is it? But maybe it is. I don't know if you have any insight or expectation that would lead to that, of saying, like, yeah, this is going to feel like a different, and I don't mean from, like, the, you got to save Marvel's, you know, floundering, sure. But just, like, is this going to be new, or is this just going to be sort of a little bit edgy, but Marvel? Like,
yeah, to me, unfortunately, it has a little bit of a Suicide Squad feel to it. You take the villains, you know, existing villains, and you put them together as a team. I guess the answer to that would be, I'm intrigued to see what has to get them together. Like, what is the driving force? I think it's Lewis Pullman's character. He's playing a character called Sentinel, and Sentinel is, like, Marvel's answer to Superman.
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah, he's the most powerful character that you can get, and he has basically Superman's powers. If he's being held somewhere and they have to go either retrieve him or stop him kind of thing, then I'm intrigued to see what that is. I think it's probably hinting at something, a bigger threat that could be affecting the Marvel Cinematic Universe moving forward, but I think largely it's going to be the dynamic of these characters together. And that's what sells me. I'm glad that it starts with a Yelena and Red Guardian, you know, father daughter thing between Florence Pugh and David Harbour. Like, I want to see these actors get a chance to sort of play off of each other, because I think they're all really good actors, and I want to see more character interactions between them and less of the action. I'm not really that interested in what the action is going
to
be for.
And
this.
I was excited to see Wyatt Russell, because I really like Wyatt Russell, and I do like his John Walker character. The show that he was in just wasn't very good. And so there's sort of a disappointment, or sort of like a, like it feels like there's a lot left on the table. I'm kind of excited to see what he can do there, or like what's up for that character. The Lewis Pullman thing I think is really interesting, because I don't really know anything about that. That feels like to me like the total wild card for this, compared to sort of having an understanding of everybody else.
Kev, you've been up and down on Marvel.
I didn't even know what Thunderpool. I didn't know what Thunderbolts was.
I mean, most people don't. Good. I don't think anyone does until this movie.
I thought I was watching a Black Widow sequel when the trailer opened. And I love David Harbour, and I love Florence Pugh, and I don't know. I'm just, Deadpool Wolverine was such a bright light in my mind about, like, because Marvel just has felt like puzzle pieces being put together to lead to the next reveal. And I just love the standalone nature of Deadpool Wolverine. This feels like, again, like another setup to continuing the, I don't know what my entire takeaway on that trailer is, that I want to watch Fight Club again.
Fight Club. Why?
Because they're using Pixies. Where's my mind? The entire trailer. And like,
I like the song choice.
I love that song. But all I kept thinking to myself was, oh man, I haven't seen Fincher's Fight Club in a long time. And like that scene when that song hits, you guys remember the first time you saw Fight Club and that song? I didn't know what that song was. I had never heard the Pixies. Where is my mind? Or where is your? Is it Where is my mind? Or where is your mind?
Where is
my mind? Right. But all I kept thinking about during the trailer was, I want to go home, put my Blu-ray of Fight Club in, and watch that reveal when they reveal Tyler Durden is, spoiler alert, is the character. But do you remember how epic it was, like when the buildings are like exploding and that song? I mean, it's epic because the song is playing, but like, oh my gosh. And the, I want to revisit. When was the last time each of you saw Fight Club? When was the last time you watched it?
Decades.
Has it been over 10 years?
Oh yeah,
when was the last time you saw it, Gabe? It's probably been over 10 years for me.
Been like a decade. Yeah, I feel like I was probably in college the last time I saw that.
I go back to Seven and Zodiac and Social Network way more than I go back to Fight Club.
I feel like Fight Club could be a cool rewatch.
Fight Club's good.
I'm sure it's still phenomenal.
I always the Jared Leto scene when he gets his face thrown into the cement is just so brutal to watch. It's such a brutal movie.
Did you guys ever watch Jake Schreier is directing Thunderbolts? I think it's his first feature, Robot and Frank. Did you guys ever watch that? Came out.
No, like, I heard really good things about it, though.
I recommend it to anyone. I haven't seen it in a while. It's probably worth a rewatch. Some of the details are sort of fuzzy. But one that I really loved when it came out, Frank Langella plays like a retired thief, like cat burglar, and and his son, like as he like needs help around the house, like he's, you know, getting older and older, buys this robot that's supposed to be sort of like a caretaker robot, and it's sort of set like a, you know, AI sentient type robot thing, cute little robot, played by voiced by Peter Sarsgaard, who does a really great voice for it.
Oh, that's but the cool. It's a show?
No, it's a movie. It's a movie. And the sort of fun thing is, so he used to be a burglar. He gets the, you know, his son who's like trying to, you know, live his life and not take care of his dad or whatever, gets in this robot, and then they kind of become friends. And then it's about them, the robot and Frank becoming trying to do a heist themselves. getting back into it. And it's, like I said, the details are fuzzy because it came out in like 2012, and I think the last time I saw it was around then. But one that I recommend to anybody if it pops up. It's a really fun, cute movie.
Also, random side note before we close out, I went and saw The Substance in theaters since we last recorded our show, because I'd seen it on a screener. Go see that movie. It is insane in a movie theater.
Like, I tried to see
sound design. Oh my God.
I tried to see it yesterday, and I went out to my car, and my car was having a hard time starting, so I had to bring it to the mechanic and get a battery change and an oil change. My car needed some new substance. But I've heard something about The Substance, and let me ask you this. Is there a really bad teeth scene in it?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
then I might not be able to watch it.
They don't just give you teeth. They give you teeth and fingernails in the same.
See, but I can't. I have a tooth. This is a real problem.
The tooth one is really disturbing. It is so gross.
Someone said in the comments underneath our last video that they know that I have a tooth phobia.
Oh, like, yeah.
I have a weird problem with teeth, and I don't know if it's gonna. I legitimately don't want to watch the movie now because I know that. Because I know that that's happening.
A really gross scene. That's probably one of the hardest scenes to watch in the film, to be honest. And the sound design.
I don't know, maybe I'll wait and watch it at home.
Can you
I
like know, anything dentists can you do anything with, like remember the scene in Final Destination, is it one or is it two or three, where the kid is at the dentist and
no you don't understand I have a problem now, like I'm gonna feel weird stuff on my teeth now for the rest of the day. It's weird. It's like a phobia.
We
it's
should do an episode phobia. Where you're getting a root canal.
Oh, God.
Or just no. Right after while he's still drugged.
Whole episode.
All right. Call to action this week. Head to the comments and let us know if you are actually going to go see Megalopolis in theaters. If you do go see Megalopolis, I want to hear your reactions. Yeah,
and let me dissuade you. Go give yourself the opinion, ability to see it and then come to your own opinion. It just didn't work for me. But
it is Coppola.
Maybe it's a second viewing type of thing. You never know.
You think you're going to sit down for 2.5 hours or whatever?
Hell no. I would if you guys came back and were like, guys, Kevin, that's the best movie I've ever seen in my life. How did you not understand or get why this film was so brilliant? I'll go, okay, all right, let me give it one more try. But I just found it to be, irritating.
When you saw The Substance, did you have a full house?
Yeah, it was sold out. Oh, dude, there's nothing crazier than watching that film with an audience, because there's a moment where the film goes into the body horror. And like I saw at least 7 people, like they were covering their eyes the entire rest of the film, like they couldn't handle it. And Demi Moore is unbelievable. Mark Qualley is incredible. Dennis Quaid is incredible. It's one of the best edited and shot films I've seen in a while. There was a critic there. Is it David Ehrlich? Is that it was because I was at an event, IndieWire, and he had a great connection. It reminded him of Requiem for a Dream in the editing style. That's kind of what it feels like. You're watching Requiem, but in a different storyline in a way. So well done.
All right. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. In the meantime, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovac, and at the show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week. And I can say that I saw Night Bitch.
Oh, nice.
Dunkirk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.